Welcome to 101.5 FM Community Conversations on Wildfire. We're here to help you stay safe, informed, and ready. I'm your host, J.D. Haas. When wildfire embers travels on the wind, they can ignite homes from far from the fire's edge. But what if your home could be built or landscaped to resist those embers? Today, we're diving into the space around your home. It's not just about fire trucks or evacuations. It's about creating ember-resistant zones to defend your home during wildfire season. We'll unpack what the research shows and what simple steps can make the biggest difference. We're joined by a special guest today who's joined to help us understand how you can make your home more resilient starting at the ground level. Here today is Steve Hawks, Senior Director for Wildfire at the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, or IBHS, a nonprofit that studies how to make homes and communities more resilient to natural hazards. Welcome, Steve. Hey, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and IBHS's mission and your role in wildfire research and outreach?
Yeah, I'm the Senior Director for wildfire at IBHS. And my background is in the California Fire Service. I worked for Cal Fire for 30 years, the first 24 years in the field, from firefighter to battalion chief, responding to emergencies across the state of California, with a lot of wildfires being a part of that. And then I transitioned the last 6+ years to working underneath the Office of the State Fire Marshal in a division called the Community Wildfire Preparedness and Mitigation Division, where we focused on programs that would help homeowners and communities with reducing their wildfire risk. And worked in that up until my retirement as Assistant Deputy Director in 2022.
Okay.
And at IBHS,
yep,
we are a nonprofit organization that conducts research on how 4 different perils, wind-driven rain, hail, and wildfire impact homes and businesses, and what are the vulnerabilities from those 4 perils. And on the wildfire side, we are really focused on how do we significantly reduce a wildfire that burns into a community and reduce it from becoming a urban conflagration and significantly reducing the number of structures that are lost during these high intensity fires. And my role at IBHS is really helping with everything we do related to wildfire, whether it's our research with helping to design some components of the research projects, to organizing our post-fire analysis that we do after these high intensity wildfires. And we were most recently deployed to the Eaton and Palisades fires January. And then also helping with the 2 programs that we have available for homeowners and communities that offer a designation, the Wildfire Prepared Home and Wildfire Prepared Neighborhood programs.
Wow, that's a lot. So you guys are deep in it. And from what I understand, your team actually recreates wildfire conditions in a lab?
That's right. Yeah, we have a state-of-the-art, one-of-a-kind facility in the world that is located in Richburg, South Carolina, and it's called a research center. And at that research center, we have a test chamber. And at the test chamber, we have a bank of 105 fans that are 6 feet in diameter, and collectively, they can blow up to 135 mile an hour wind. And that wind gets narrowed down through some concrete tunnels and then enters into a big 6-story concrete structure. And in the middle of that concrete structure is a turntable. And so we can build a full-size structure, about 1,600 square feet, place it in that turntable, and then orient the structure any way we want, to any direction we want, to the bank of fans, and then expose it to just the wind itself, or we can expose it to rain, wind-driven rain, hail. And for wildfire inside the test chamber, we burn wood mulch and dowels and to create embers, and then cast those embers onto the structure to see how the structure and its immediate surroundings performs as a systems-based approach or a system of components, just as a house would experience a real wildfire event. And then on the backside of our test chamber, we can blow the wind through it and out the back end, and we can conduct structure-to-structure fire spread experiments, looking at that really complex relationship of how structures influence each other when they're close by, and what is this correct spacing, what are the building materials that help reduce that possibility of one structure igniting the next one downwind, and all the other factors that go in with that.
Wow, that is so interesting. I had no idea that it was that deep, Steve. And you kept using the word embers, and it's all about understanding the ember threat. Today's episode is on home hardening and why it matters. Now, most of us as well in the community, we often think of walls of flame. But it's embers that pose the biggest risk. Can you explain that?
Yes, absolutely. So a wildfire exposes a structure from three different ways. So it's direct flame contact, radiant heat from something that's burning close by the structure that can burn with enough energy and long enough that it can ignite a vulnerable component of the home, or the embers, as we were just talked about here, that we have really determined to be the leading factor of home ignitions. And it's really, you kind of think of it as that big wall of flames that's so impressive when you see that. And they definitely, the flaming front does impact and lead to structure loss. But it's really those small embers that get lofted in the air and carried downwind. And when they land, they can ignite combustible items that are the leading cause of structure ignition.
Okay, so this might surprise a lot of people. I learned this, according to you guys at the IBHS, as many as 90% of homes and buildings damaged or destroyed in wildfires were first ignited by embers or other fires set by embers, and not the main wildland fire front. Can you elaborate more on that?
Yeah, that 90% figure comes from post-fire analysis we did on the Waldo Canyon fire in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And we generally say that embers are the leading cause of home ignitions. And embers, you can also maybe hear them referred to as firebrands. And they are small components of a combustible object that is burning that gets lofted in the air from the heat of the fire. So the heat pushes those embers up, and then the wind can carry those embers with the wind downstream. And when they land, they can either lead to the ignition of a structure, what we call directly or indirectly. And what I mean by that is if the ember lands on the structure, like a roof material or debris that's accumulated on the roof line, it can ignite that item, leading to the loss of the structure. It can also directly ignite the structure by passing through inside the structure, like an opening or a vent or something similar, where there is a void space where the ember can pass through to the inside and land on a combustible item and ignite the structure on the inside. So those are really the two ways that an ember directly ignites a structure. Indirectly, the ember can land nearby the structure, in particular that first 5 feet that surrounds the house, and lead to the ignition of a combustible item. And then that item leads to the ignition of the house.
So would that be the ember resistance zone? Because you and your team at IBHS help define what's called the ember resistance zone. Can you give it to us in practical terms?
Yes, absolutely. So there are many terms you might hear out there about this, the first 5 feet that surrounds the house and other attachments like decks and pergolas and porches and things. Ember resistant zone is one of them. Zone zero is another one that's really here, a California term. And then non-combustible zone, which is typically how we describe that 5 feet. And then NFPA refers to it as the immediate zone. So any one of those terms refers to that first 5 feet. And that concept of that first 5 feet being so critical for defending a home really goes back to just over the hill from Truckee in Lake Tahoe in the north part of the Tahoe area in the Nevada side, and in the early 90s. And then Dr. Steve Quarles at IBHS, which was our lead wildfire scientist, brought that concept to IBHS, and we began to really look at that through our research and post-fire analysis and focus on that area. And we have determined through all of that effort that that first 5 feet of all the area that surrounds the house is absolutely critical and the most important area in defending a home of all the area that surrounds the house.
Okay, so Steve, what part of the home is most vulnerable to the wildfire embers? You're saying it's that first 5 feet, but there's parts of the home. Can you give us more info on that?
Yeah, of the area that surrounds the home, that first 5 feet is the most critical. On the home itself, it's really the roof is the most critical area. When you have roofing material that is combustible, like typically an older style wood shake roof. Fortunately, here in California, over 99% of all roofs are a Class A fire rated roof, which provides the highest level of protection. But still, there are vulnerabilities that could be there even with a Class A roof. If you have like a barrel tile roof or metal roof where there's a gap at the roof edge where debris can get underneath it, embers can find that and ignite it. Debris can accumulate on the roof line and embers can find those as well. So it's still, even though the roofing material is much better on homes these days, it can still have vulnerabilities with accumulation of debris and other things on the roof. And some of the other areas that are very critical for embers, and I already mentioned the 5 foot area that surrounds the house, but vents are another one. Many homes have older style vents with mesh that have a gap in them that is greater than 1/8 inch. Typically, that's about at 1/4, maybe even up to 1/2 inch. Those 1/4 and greater mesh vents can allow embers to pass through them that have enough energy in them that when they land on a combustible item on the inside, a single ember can ignite that item, leading to the structure starting on fire from the inside and burning, leading to its loss. And a couple other areas that can be vulnerable to embers are gutters, the bottom 6 inches of any vertical surface. So, like at the wall where it meets the ground, where a vertical and horizontal surface comes together, or a wall and a deck, and then decks themselves.
Okay. I want to backtrack just a hair because a lot of folks, we have metal roofs up here. Can you give me more information and the listener a little bit about how the embers and what they should do to work on that open zone, as you were talking about, under the metal roof?
The metal roofs can have a ridge to them, and at where the roof edge meets the roofing material at the edge of the roof, at like the eave line, there could be a gap there, which is greater than 1/8 of an inch, which could allow debris to blow in, or birds to put debris in there, or squirrels, whatnot, and so you can fill that area with a non-combustible material, and they make commercially available what's called bird stops to put in that space. And you can also fill that space with a mineral wool item, which is a non-combustible alternative.
Okay. Let's get to the most common mistake. Truckee's considered a high-risk area. What is the most common mistake homeowners make when it comes to fire resistance?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we always hear is that this is somebody else's problem. This is not going to happen here. It's not my problem until it does. And so just understanding and really appreciating that these wildfires that we are experiencing today are much different than the wildfires that we experienced decades ago. Even when I was a first-year seasonal firefighter, these wildfires are burning with much more intensity and severity and speed, and impacting communities and outpacing the ability of firefighters to defend homes, because their primary focus is really on life safety and getting people out of harm's way. Meanwhile, the wildfire will continue to burn. So just understanding that there is a real threat from these wildfires and appreciate the potential that these have. And then taking the actions that are necessary And then going the distance. So just like working on your roof, maybe clearing the roof of debris, their gutters of debris, re retrofitting your vents, doing a few things is great and a good first step. But under these high intensity fires, it has to be a systems-based approach. When you leave even one vulnerability, these fires can exploit that and lead to the loss of the house. So you have to go the full distance and ensure that your home is protected as much as possible. And that could be different for each home. Each home is unique in what it was, materials it was made out of, in the style of construction, in its location on the land, and what fuel surrounds it. So really, it needs to be evaluated each home as to what mitigation actions need to occur.
All right, let's get these things prioritized because it's starting to feel pretty overwhelming. Let's get into specifics, Steve. Say you're walking up to a typical home in Truckee. What are the first things you're looking at in terms of fire vulnerability?
I usually start in the front of the house and start at the roof and work my way down, looking at all the components and the materials that they're made out of, from the roof to the ground, and then out from the house, looking at that 5 foot area, and then going further out. And again, it's not really just one thing, it's all of those components, and seeing what is a vulnerability and how can we change that from being a vulnerability to being something that can no longer be exploited by the fire. So, and then working our way around the house in a maybe like a clockwise fashion, looking at the left side of the house, then the back, and then the right side as we come around, and really examining all of the structure and its surroundings. And it's really about the fuel component of how do we manage the fuel from being a vulnerability. And when I say fuel in the context of a fire that's entered into a community, it's anything that can burn. And that's one of the other, I think, misconceptions is don't necessarily think of maybe my shed as being a vulnerability that's 10 feet away from my house, or a wood fence that's attached directly to the side of my house, or other things. So in the context of these urban fires, it's anything that's combustible can ignite and create additional embers, heat, and flames, and lead to the spread of the fire. So it's taking a look at all of those things, and then how can I change that fuel that's vulnerable, and can I remove it from the property? Can I put it farther away on the property so if it ignites, it doesn't lead to the direct ignition of the home? Can I make it more resilient itself, like changing a wood fence within 5 feet of the house to a non-combustible alternative? Or can I make the home itself more resilient through the use of better materials on the exterior components? And that's generally non-combustible materials.
Oh man, that's a lot. Okay, we talked about this earlier, but let's get back into vents. And for those just tuning in to the podcast, why are they so dangerous during that wildfire again? And what are some affordable ways to upgrade them?
It wasn't until about 2010 that events really changed from research conducted at our research center, from the minimum requirement of a quarter inch to down to between 1/16th and 1/8th of an inch, or the maximum requirement of a quarter inch, excuse me. And so now the maximum is 1/8 inch. So you'll still have embers that'll pass through a vent, even with a mesh size of 1/8 inch. But they once they pass through, as long as there's not something combustible like storage of a combustible item like a box with things in it that can immediately provide a block where those embers bang up against that item and then drop to the ground and accumulate, leading to the ignition of that, those embers usually typically flow into the attic space and then randomly just float around and land, and don't accumulate in any great quantity enough to ignite the inside of the attic. So that's the vulnerability of vents. And so retrofitting those vents with a smaller mesh, and we recommend 1/8 inch because a vent still needs to perform its main function of why it's there, of air exchange between the inside of the house and the outside, and not lead to moisture issues or mold inside the attic space. And so that's why we recommend the 1/8 inch mesh.
Okay.
But you can retrofit that vent by replacing the old vent with a new one, or cutting out the mesh and replacing it with the new right size mesh, or some simple ways to retrofit.
All right. Let's talk about other areas of the home. Decks and siding. What materials do you recommend for decks and siding in these wildfire zones? And are there any cost-effective options for people who can't afford a full replacement right now?
Yeah, these can be some of the more expensive items to retrofit. So, when it comes to siding, if you have siding material that's combustible, or maybe termed as ignition resistant, where it resists ignition but it can at some point ignite and allow for the spread of the fire on the outside of it, we recommend at least the bottom 6 inches of that siding being replaced with a non-combustible alternative. And the bottom 6 inches is really important. As I mentioned earlier, it's that area where a vertical surface and a horizontal surface come together, where debris like pine needles and leaves can blow during the wind that accompanies generally these high intensity fires, and blow up against the side of the house and accumulate. And then when embers find that material, it's easy to ignite that, and it can lead to the ignition of the siding. So replacing that bottom 6 inches with a non-combustible alternative, if you can't replace all the siding with a non-combustible alternative, is a good first step. And then for decks, really limiting the amount of combustible items you have on top of a deck, underneath the deck. If you have less than 4 feet from the walking surface to the ground, enclosing that area with metal mesh that has that 1/8 inch gap again, that prevents the accumulation of debris underneath the deck and the embers going underneath there and finding that debris. And don't store anything combustible underneath the deck. And those posts that touch the ground, wrapping them with a 6 inches of non-combustible material, as well as the bottom step that reaches the ground, ensuring that it has non-combustible material there as well. And that's just helps protect against those embers accumulating and then potentially igniting those items. And then if you want to take it one step further, you can really look at that last stretch about 5 feet of the deck as it reaches the house, and look to change that the walking surface as well as the railings out with a non-combustible alternative, and then also the 6 inches above the deck on the wall.
Okay. And you were talking just briefly earlier about that 6 inches off the siding. And that's a lot of, oftentimes that is landscaping around that. How does landscaping affect a home's wildfire resilience? And then we can get into the fences as well, because I'm sitting here thinking about fences. What kind of fence should we use? So let's go into landscaping first and then hit fences.
Okay, so it's really that first 5 feet, and looking at what is combustible in that area, and then moving it away, and not having anything combustible there. That's where embers can land and ignite items like mulch and fences and landscaping plants and so forth. And when you have even a small fire right up against the side of the house, or right close by, it can lead to the ignition of a vulnerable component of the structure. So it's moving those away, at least out of that 5 feet. And then from the next zone, that 5 to 30 foot area, have trees, have plants, have grass, have wood mulch to help with moisture in the ground, have other combustible items in that area. Just be conscious of where you place them, so that you don't put too much fuel right close to each other. We don't want to create kind of an agglomeration of fuel that ignites and then creates a real high intensity fire close to the structure. So space things out, both horizontally and vertically. We don't want a fire that is burning on the ground to have a ladder, so to speak, to climb from the ground up into the trees, and which is becomes at that point a more intense fire, and much harder if you have firefighters on site for them to defend the structure, and as greater potential of igniting the house. And then for fences, it's really that last 5 feet again that that is out from the wall of the structure, replacing that with a non-combustible alternative. And there's different ways to go about doing that, from block to metal fencing, or no fencing at all if you just want to go with that route. Just that last 5 feet, it just provides that clear pathway for the fire to burn right along it to right to the side of the house and ignite the house. But if you replace that with a non-combustible alternative, the fire on the fence will simply hit that 5 foot mark and burn itself out.
Okay. Well, there's probably someone out there listening who feels overwhelmed right now. Vents, roofs, decks, costs. Steve, what's your message to them?
Yeah, I can definitely understand why this might seem overwhelming. But the good news is there are definitely things that we can do to significantly reduce our risk to make our homes more survivable from even these high intensity fires. So a good starting point is to you can go to our website, wildfireprepared.org, and download the How to Prepare My House checklist and compare your home to that checklist, and then make a list of the vulnerabilities that you have. And as I mentioned earlier, each home is unique, and the materials that were used on during the construction, the style of construction, and its surrounding area. So each home might have a different list of things that are vulnerable with it. And so create that list, and then what things can you do as a DIY type project? Start tackling those first, and then develop a plan of dealing with the rest of them that you might need some assistance with, whether financially or through a contractor to help you. But don't think that there's nothing you can do, because there are definitely things that you can do to reduce your risk. And but don't delay. Get started.
Okay, so give us some specifics here. Not everyone can afford a full home retrofit, but what are a few upgrades that give you a lot of protection without breaking the bank?
Yeah, some things are really just require some routine maintenance. And as I mentioned earlier, over 99% of roofs in California are Class A fire rated, which is great. But even with that, there's still some maintenance that's required. So if the roof has debris that's accumulated on top of it, clear that debris off. Just be careful while you're up there on the roof. We don't want to see anyone fall off. And then also, if you're missing any of that roofing material, make sure you replace that and eliminate that as a potential vulnerability. Address those areas, as I mentioned earlier, where the roofing material may have a little bit of gap at the roof's edge with those bird stops. Ensure that those are in place. Gutters, clear out gutters of debris, and you can install metal gutter covers on them to help limit the amount of debris that enters or rests on top of the gutter cover. Vents are another one that's a high vulnerability, and also something that could potentially be easily, depending on your style of house and location of vents and whatnot, as a retrofit item. And then that first 5 feet. Again, I can't understate how critically that first 5 feet is of having nothing combustible in there. So remove the mulch, take the wood fence off the side of the house, move plants out of that area and place them at least 5 feet or greater than away from the house. And other combustible items in that area, just move that away.
Okay, so it sounds like a lot of that stuff homeowners can do themselves. But let's take that versus what requires a contractor. Can you break a couple of those things down?
Yeah, we did, talk about a few things like maintenance on roofs, gutters, vents, and in the 0 to 5 foot area that can be more of a DIY type project, and get started with those, mitigate those vulnerabilities right away. And then if you have items like the siding, if and decks, and if your roof really needs to be replaced altogether. Windows are another one, eaves. Some of these are your more costly and maybe more involved projects. And so develop a plan of which ones you can tackle first, and what you might need help with from a contractor, and reach out to a contractor, get bids, reach out to your local fire authority, and see if there's help that they could provide maybe they have some grant program funding that's available to assist you with these projects or some advice for you with undertaking them. Maybe there's community groups that can assist you with some of this work. So, but develop a plan and then work towards checking each item off of that list.
Yeah, and Truckee Fire, they do offer a $2,000 match in their home hardening program. You can find out about that at truckeefire.org. And with that match, I mean, the next thing is, let's say we've got a weekend and $500, maybe that's $1,000 with the Truckee Fire match. What should someone do? If they had $500 right now and they're listening, what would you recommend they should do?
Look at their roof and mitigate any vulnerability. So take debris that's accumulated off the roof,
Okay.
replace any missing shingles or anything like that, or material. Clean out your gutters, retrofit your vents so that they have 1/8 inch metal mesh. Take care of that 0 to 5 foot area that surrounds the house and other attachments, moving all combustibles out of that area. These are some of the things that are low cost and are very meaningful as far as risk reduction goes. And then in other combustible items that are larger, can you move them further away from the house, even at least 10 feet from the house, like a shed? Can you move it at least 10 feet out so that if it does ignite, there's less direct flame contact potential as well as radiant heat exposure?
Okay. Now, you started at the roof up there. Give some tips on phasing these upgrades. Is it from roof down? How do you do the phasing?
Yeah, and so it really depends on your situation and all the vulnerabilities that you might have to mitigate. And so look at that list that you've created of all those vulnerabilities. Start with those things that are easy for you to do as a DIY type project. As much as we'd like to see homeowners mitigate all their vulnerabilities with the structure in a quick amount of time, we know that this can be very challenging and be time consuming. So just start working on them. Some of those higher priority areas are the roof, vents, that first 5 feet that surrounds the house, gutters, just clearing out the debris, mitigating the exposure from embers. Those are the, as we mentioned earlier in this broadcast, that embers are the leading cause of structural ignition. So mitigating that risk from the embers, which is the roof, gutters, vents, the bottom 6 inches of a vertical surface like the wall, that first 5 feet out from the house, that's a good starting point. And then once you've mitigated the risk from the embers, then continue going to mitigate the risk from the flames and the radiant heat.
Okay. Have you ever worked with someone who really turned things around with some smart upgrades?
We work with a lot of different people in our Wildfire Prepared Home program with helping them meet the either the base or the plus level designation that we have, and then getting a certificate of designation. We typically, though, have not tracked them after the designation to, and we haven't had a home yet that has been completely impacted by one of these high intensity fires. We've had a few homes that have been near one of these fires that would likely have been exposed from the embers.
Okay.
But we know from our post-fire analysis that these are the right mitigation actions. We've seen that when homes take these steps, that they have a higher chance of survival. I have a couple examples. You might have recalled the Red Roof House and the Lahaina fire that prior to the fire took a couple steps, not really for wildfire mitigation in mind, but nonetheless, they still had a benefit for reducing the risk from the wildfire, and that house survived. And then more recently on the Palisades fire, that passive design house that we probably all saw in the news featured quite a bit, had many features of a resilient house from wildfire, and it survived. So we know that these things work both from our research, from our post-fire analysis.
Now, have you ever worked with a homeowner who thought they were fire ready but weren't? And if so, what caught them by surprise other than the fire?
Yeah, I think it's the realization of the full extent of the issue and what needs to be done to significantly reduce the risk from wildfire. And understanding that fuel is much more than just plants and trees and mulch, and it's anything that's combustible that can ignite and burn and allow for the spread of the fire and lead to the loss of the house. So, and then also that systems-based approach that under these high-intensity fires, even one vulnerability can be exploited by that fire and lead to the loss of the house.
How does all of this connect to insurance and the broader community efforts?
Yeah, the first point is really about making homes more resilient and survivable to these high-intensity fires and giving them the best chance of you returning to a home that's still standing after a wildfire. And we really have a what Dr. Jack Cohen, a fire scientist from the Forest Service, very well known for his research and the ignitability of homes, and who's now retired, but he said that we have a home ignition problem, and he's spot on. These high-intensity fires don't have to lead to conflagration and large structure loss, but they are because we have homes that are very vulnerable to these types of fires. And so if we can make them more resilient, then we can significantly reduce the loss, which brings us to why we have an insurance crisis, because we have a significant number of homes that are being destroyed during these very severe wildfires. And so if we can make homes more survivable, we can also make them more insurable.
Okay. So what is IBHS's Wildfire Prepared Home Program, and how can your certification help?
Yeah, so it's a systems-based approach, as I talked about. It's based in over 10 years of research and field deployments that we have conducted, as well as the research from other renowned organizations like the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, the Underwriters Laboratory Fire Safety Research, and other academic organizations. And it's that systems-based approach that addresses the house from the roof to the ground and all the components and the materials that it's made out of and the immediate surrounding areas. And it looks to reduce the exposure of combustible items while making the home itself more resilient. And there's two levels of designation: wildfire prepared home, or you might hear it referred to as the base level, which is really designed for an existing home that needs to be retrofitted to be more resilient. And it incorporates mitigation actions that address all those features that are most vulnerable to the ember exposure from the fire. And then the plus level designation builds upon all the requirements in the base level and adds on the additional components of the structure and some additional requirements for the surrounding area that are most vulnerable from the direct flames and radiant heat of the fire. So it addresses the windows and eaves and siding and the deck more so, and other components of the house. And with that, when you achieve the designation and you have that certificate in hand, then that opens doors for you to have meaningful conversations with various insurance carriers across the state for insurability of homes. And that signifies to them that this home has taken meaningful risk reduction measures, and that has been validated by IBHS.
Okay, Steve, thank you so much for sharing your expertise. Any final closing thoughts for the listeners?
Just going back to a point I made earlier that we are not powerless against these intense wildfires, that there's absolutely meaningful risk mitigation measures that we can take. It's just that systems-based approach, and we really urge homeowners to go to our website, wildfireprepared.org, download the How to Prepare My Home checklist, print it off, walk around your house, compare your house to that checklist, develop a list of mitigation measures that you need to take on your house, and then start working on checking each one of those items off the list. Start with those DIY type projects and then figure out how you can address the other actions that you might need some assistance with, whether financial or contractor assistance with. So But go the full distance as you can, and go the full distance because, again, these high-intensity wildfires, even one vulnerability can lead to the loss of the house.
Steve Hawks, thank you so much for all this in-depth information. I am going to have to get directly home and start working on this. I am not ready. And folks, I just want to let you know a little bit about Steve Hawks. Steve Hawks joined the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. That is the IBHS. That's in 2023. And he currently serves as a senior director for wildfire. And in his role, Steve works to advance wildfire policy and code development, manages IBHS's post-fire analysis research, assists with wildfire prepared home program, and develops future designation program opportunity. Steve also serves on the Underwriters Laboratory Fire Safety Research Institute Wildfire Advisory Committee and Cal Poly's San Luis Obispo WUI Fire Institute Advisory Council. Steve Hawks, you are just a wealth of information, and I thank you for your time here on helping us stay safe and wildfire ready. Thank you again.
Thank you, JD. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Well, so much great information from Steve Hawks. I am so grateful that he took the time to sit with us here at 101.5. And just a reminder to everybody out there, truckeefire.org, they do have a home hardening rebate, and they will help match dollar for dollar up to $2,000. You can find that at truckeefire.org/harden your home. And then there's also the Truckee Fire's inspection program. And if you didn't get the initial inspection, it actually ended up on your door handle. You can actually go to truckeefire.org to schedule your home inspection with Truckee Fire. And as well, you should start with one zone this week. Even 1 hour cleanup is progress. And again, that is home hardening. And Truckee residents, you may be eligible up to $2,000 in that home hardening rebates, as I said. And residents can schedule a free defensible space inspection with Truckee Fire. It's a great way to get feedback on both your landscaping and your home structure. They'll assess your property and offer tips on home hardening priorities. All that information is at truckeefire.org. I'm JD Haas, your 101.5 Community Conversations on Wildfire host. Stay safe, stay informed, and stay ready.